Blog Talk Radio.
Of the Story of Blender, of course, hosted by author Stephen James. Tonight's guest is Grant Blockwood. Get the inside scoop on fiction writing from one of the country's top techno thriller authors. Grant shares insights on research, penning books with Tom Clancy, writing action scenes, building suspense, and his face mask theory of point of view writing. Sure to be a winner. I also want to remind everybody that all the shows here on Suspense Radio Network are brought to you by Kensington Books. Make sure you check out kensingtonbooks.com for more information. And also Revell Baker Publishing. Make sure you check out revellbooks.com for more information on their authors and their releases. We want to thank you all, of course, for joining us here on the shows. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast through iTunes or wherever you find your podcast, as that's the best way in order to get the latest up-to-date shows that'll go right into your listening device. Of course, today is April Fool's Day, but there's no April Fools. We actually do have a show. And, of course, if you're listening to this, you probably are going to also know that on April the 2nd, we are going to have a Suspense Radio Inside Edition, and then 101 will be on April the 3rd. So it's going to be a very busy weekend here on Suspense Radio. But now, let's give it over to our host of the show tonight, the Story Blender. Take it away, Stephen James.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And I have to say I'm pretty stoked about tonight's show, since I get to talk to two rather than just one gifted novelists, Amy Rogers, an author of science thrillers, as well as an MD and doctor of immunology. I actually tend to forget how many degrees you actually have, Amy, but as much as I respect your work, I have to say, I still remember asking you what you did besides writing one year. I don't know if you remember what you said. This is a couple years ago. I said, so what do you do besides writing? And you said, I teach, I mom, and I wife. And I loved that. I loved how you turned them into verbs. So you are my favorite science thriller verb, mom.
Kind of sounds like a cheesy greeting card, you know. Recipe for life, you know. Teach, mom, wife. Yes.
But Amy blogs
Amy
blogs about science thrillers and writes them. And so Amy will be our co-host tonight. And Grant Blockwood is our guest. And Grant is the New York Times best-selling novelist of a number of books, as well as the number one New York Times bestseller, Dead or Alive, with Tom Clancy. He spent 3 years aboard a guided missile frigate as an operations specialist and as a pilot rescue swimmer. Grant is also the acclaimed fiction instructor at fiction events, especially thriller writing and crime and suspense novels. I know that he takes his work seriously, and he really wants to include aspiring writers raise the bar for aspiring authors and novelists. And this passion for excellence is one of the things that sets him apart and sets his writing apart. So, Grant Blockwood, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Stephen. I appreciate it. Amy, nice to meet you.
Hello.
And now I think I should say that the book Tom Clancy Under Fire was a huge hit, I know, last year. And when we were at Thriller Fest, I think it maybe had just come out. And I was thinking that the time we first met was when we were at a training event for hand-to-hand combat skills down in Phoenix, Arizona, I believe.
That's right.
I think, Grant, you are one of the few people who has seen me thrown to the ground by a martial arts expert. So congratulations on that. Unless, of course, you've posted the video somewhere on YouTube, which in that case I'm in trouble.
I want the link.
I haven't. But I'll tell you that the impressive thing was not that you were thrown to the ground. It was that you hopped right back up and you started taking notes about how you might apply that in your books. You were diligent.
I did take a lot of notes, didn't I? Now that I think back to that.
You really did.
Oh, my goodness. That was a great time, though. We got to shoot M4s and learned knife fighting, and that was tons of fun.
Has that come in handy outside the office?
Well, for me, I a lot of old ladies try to cut in line in front of me at grocery stores, so, you know, terrible things happen. No, that's not true.
They end up on the linoleum, huh?
Yeah, it's good for research, but I have thankfully had no occasion to use any of it outside.
Actually, that's a good question that can bridge into something interesting, and that is writing scenes where there is action or chase scenes. I mean, that's one of the things that your books are known for, not just as techno-thrillers, but as action being revealed, revealing characterization. People just don't sit around and think and ruminate. They move and they act, and there's action. And so when you're writing, say, a chase scene or maybe an action sequence, how do you capture that on the page? That's hard.
It is hard, and I think, the first thing I try to do is think about what the reader's expectations for that kind of scene might be, and then you can tweak those to one degree or another to make them interesting or different. But I'm also a big fan of what I teach is the scuba mask theory, in that readers are coming to your books seeing the action and feeling the action through the scuba mask that is the character's perception. And so I think if you can kind of look at that, and it's not just a vacuum through which the readers experience it, but it's through the sensibilities of whoever is living it. And I think if you can get into that mindset, you can make scenes a lot more interesting and a lot more personal.
I love it, the scuba mask theory.
Because you can only see, because you can't see off to the sides, like having blinders on.
Well, that, and also, every mask people wear comes with its own smudges and clear spots and scratches, and those are the experience and the peculiarities of their personality that color everything they experience.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's great, because a great way to write fiction that nobody wants to read is to write generic characters. They all sound the same, they all act the same, they all respond the same. We put up with that for a page or two, and that's about it.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So what do you think, the essence of an action scene is? What makes a scene not be boring?
Well, as of late, I've looked at a lot of action scenes, and I think the ones that nowadays seem a lot more exciting to me are ones that are very gritty, and they're not fancy, and it's not something you're going to see in a Hollywood movie. It is on the page what, a real physical confrontation looks like. It's ugly and it's brutal, and it's often is over very fast. And I think kind of getting that immediacy onto the page is really powerful. And I try to stay true to the the non-fancy style of action, because it is dangerous and dirty, and people get hurt. Not that I relish that, but that's the truth of it.
Yeah, John Dixon is a young adult author I had on here, I think it was last year, and he is a Golden Gloves boxer. Now he writes youth fiction, and he's just a great guy. And he said this sort of the same kind of things that you just said, Grant, that it's fast in real life, and it's not pretty. And so, because I asked him about writing, fight scenes, because he's a boxer. And he's like, most fights in the movies might go on for 5 minutes. He's like, that's not the way it happens in real life.
No.
It's
and
fast. People go down hard.
They go down hard, and things that you plan rarely come off exactly as you plan them. And there's an old saying in the military is that no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Huh.
Or to put it in another way, everybody's got a plan until they get hit in the face.
Hmm.
And then your plan changes, and that's the nature of that kind of stuff.
So when you
They sometimes say about action that it actually releases tension when people start running and bullets start flying, that the tension sort of dissipates. How do you use your action scenes to really, you know, get the reader in and want them to stay with it and to stay, you know, tense as the action plays out?
Well, I think, of course, you know, they have to care about the people going in, but also I think that you, at least from my perspective, you really need to be clear at some point, either immediately before the scene or in a build-up, that there are high stakes involved in this action scene. It's not just a car chase for a car chase. It's they will win or lose or learn this or not learn this or catch so-and-so. And so the reader goes into it, one, caring what happens to characters, but two, knowing what the failure or success of that action scene will mean. And that makes them, I think, more invested in it. It's not just exciting because the car is going fast. It's exciting because if the car doesn't go fast enough, they don't catch the bad guy.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, it seems like the more people I talk with who are successful writers, both novels, screenplays, even memoirs and personal stories, they emphasize these same aspects over and over. What does my character want? What are the stakes? What's keeping him from getting it? And how can I reveal what matters to him by the choices that he makes in the pursuit of what he wishes to attain? And it's like, I almost wonder, is this stuff not being taught in English classes and stuff? Because it's so vital. And everyone who's successful that I talk to focuses on these things. But sometimes when I talk to aspiring writers, they're like, oh, I never really thought about it like that.
Yeah, and I think in the beginning I was the same. It's writing a novel, you know, of 100,000 plus words, it's a complex, I mean, I don't think complex is a word that does it justice, but it's such a complex, organic thing that you can easily get overwhelmed with all the things that you need to get right in the beginning. And so, you know, when I was starting out, I didn't even know what I didn't know.
Right.
As an aspiring writer. And I think it's once you have some awareness that you're not doing something very well or at all, then you kind of open your eyes and say, well, okay, this is yet another piece of the organic beast I've got to look into.
That is very true. I just had this flashback to a scene in my own life when I had just started writing and I had this great idea for a book, or so I thought. Actually, it was a good idea. The idea was good. And so I had started writing. Just writing this thing. I knew nothing. I'd taken no classes in writing. And I went to a writer's conference to try to get some sense of what I did not know, which turned out to be an immense amount. But I was standing in conversation with a group of writers and a literary agent, and I was just listening because I had nothing to say at that point. And the group sort of broke up, and I was left with the literary agent, and he asked me, so tell me about your protagonist. And I got this blank look on my face as my brain went empty, and I'm like thinking, what exactly is that? And then I'm like, I don't think I have that. And I knew that I had a long way to go at that point.
Yeah, I mean, when I was starting out, I would think about characterization. And when I was really starting, I don't know that I could actually define, you know, how do you characterize someone? It wasn't until I got well into it, you know, years into it, that I started to realize, okay, this is what characterization means. Up until then, it was this fuzzy concept that I knew I needed, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And it was enlightening and embarrassing at the same time to realize that.
So at this point, what would you say are a couple of the key points to characterization that you've picked up over the years?
I think scuba lens is a big thing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, knowing the baggage that every character comes into the scene with, knowing what the character's overarching motivation is, knowing what their motivation is in that scene, and kind of having played with the outcomes. If they get what they want, what happens? If they don't get what they want, what happens? And from there, you've got, you know, kind of the building blocks for a good scene.
Yeah.
If you string hopefully enough of those together, then you've got a good book.
Now, Grant, when you work, do you know that overarching motivation before you really dive in, or is that something that emerges for you as you develop and work on the story?
It's happened both ways, but some of the books I've worked on, some of the co-authored books, have been very straightforward with characterization. Jack Ryan Jr., who is Tom Clancy's protagonist in this kind of new universe, he just wants to be, a good soldier and do the right things for his country. And so some of the motivations, you don't need this big arching sweep. But, yeah, there are times I'll get into a book and I'll realize that what I thought was the overarching motivation is just a little bit of it. And then I've kind of reevaluate how I look at the story and the arc.
Yeah, I think that's been true for me. What about you, Amy?
I try to have the motivations for the plot, the character motivations over the whole story arc worked out in advance. I actually find plot easier to create than character. So I like to work on the character motivations as a central part of how I'm going to develop them as they go. But definitely I find that in the course of writing, the characters come more alive, and a lot of the things about them that are not clearly defined in my mind start to fall into place through writes and rewrites of the book itself.
Yeah, well said, because there are, imagine a scene might go one way and your character is going to feel about it a certain way. But when the scene plays out and you realize that I think my character would react a little bit differently or strongly to this, and that changes everything from that point on. So I agree with Amy.
Yeah, I find that's true, for me. Like, I think I might know what the scene's about or the character and so on. And as I'm working on the book, it's almost like they're saying, no, actually, this is what I want. I'm like, and then I'll write a scene, and they'll respond in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And I think, well, that's interesting. What does that tell me about this character? For me, it's kind of this emergence. Because I find that if I think that I know at the beginning, sometimes they just kind of become shallow, and they don't end up revealing and rearing their head as much. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, Grant, I think when you were teaching at the Mastercraft Fest up in New York City, that if I recall right, you had the students come and you taught them, and then actually took their work home to critique it sort of on your own. Is that how you approached it?
Yeah, I didn't do it in class. In fact, I gave students the option to resubmit their sample to me after they took the class to see if what they learned in the class was that they could apply any of it to their sample and any light bulbs had gone on. But, yeah, I don't critique in class. One, it just takes so much time. But mainly I just want to see that they go back and take what they learned in those 10 hours and maybe rethink their sample.
See, and that actually is one of the things I really respect about you so much, is you are doing what you feel is best for the students. I mean, that's a lot of time that you're saying, okay, I'll look over your work back at home. You're not getting paid extra to do it. And some people just sit in class and critique the work. And like you said, it takes so much time, you can't cover as much ground, and you don't even know if it's sticking. So I remember when you told me that, I was like, man, that's a huge commitment. But it just shows that you really want, this next generation, the rising generation, to be great storytellers.
I do. And you and I both know, all three of us know, that this is such a tough business. And so, when you come across someone who is genuine, their love for it, and you know that they're probably at the bottom of a very long, tall hill they've got to climb, you just naturally kind of want to, you don't want to give them a ladder, but you want to show them where the good footholds are. You guys feel the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I am passionate about teaching people. When I started writing, I never really thought that would be a big aspect of what I cared about or what I was real interested in, but I like that, show them the right footholds. It's a great image. And and I really feel like that's what I want to do. And there were people, it may be true for you too, but I mean, there were people that did that for me, that showed me the footholds. And when they did, I thought, why hasn't anyone shown me this foothold before? And so, because a lot of them didn't know it was even there, you know.
Right.
Right. Well, right.
It certainly is a gift that you guys give in that. I've had the privilege of taking some instruction from both of you at Thriller Fest, and just the things that it's kind of almost amazing to me that one can learn so much in an hour sometimes about things about the craft of writing that can then be translated into the work that I'm doing. So anybody who's interested in learning about thriller writing in particular, these two guys are great resources.
Well, I talk to Stephen's students too, and they always come out of his classes very happy. So somehow we're both, I think all the instructors are doing something right, which is a good feeling.
Yeah, and you know, think about this for a sec. If you're an Apple employee, you don't go and have, you know, conferences where you invite all the people from, I don't know, Microsoft or Google or whatever, whoever your competitor is, and share with them all of the secrets and shortcuts and keys to success that you've learned over the years. But that's what we do as writers. I mean, we're basically saying to our competition, come in here, I'm going to teach you as much as I possibly can to help you be successful. And I love that. I just think that is so amazing that writers do that, and that's a big part of the writing life.
Yeah, I do too. And it's, you know, I don't know exactly why I give my students this proviso, but I always tell them that, you know, there are a lot of ways to skin the novel cat, so to speak. And so what I'm going to give them in that 10 hours is simply, you know, 28, 29 years of stuff that I've distilled down to this works for me. It's worked in the past and it works now. Whether it'll work for you in this form, I don't know, but here it is. And you can either use it or tweak it or toss it aside. Because everybody needs to find their own way. You can only help so much.
Now, when you do teach, maybe there are other events, you know, around the country, what are some of the things that you've been seeing that are kind of the areas of growth or weaknesses that tend to keep propping up in the work of kind of aspiring novelists?
Well, you know, one thing that strikes me, and I should qualify this, and that I was new to the idea of a premise line too until maybe, you know, 8 years ago. But I've been surprised at how many writers, aspiring writers who feel they're serious about it, don't even know what a premise line is and how to develop one and why it's important. And I'm not picking on them because it was something I didn't know either. But if there's one overriding light bulb moment in my classes, it's when we get the premise line and they realize, okay, this is really worth my time. So that's certainly one of them.
So talk us through sort of the steps that you have people take with the premise line.
Well, see, I'm in the middle of the deadline, so I've got to see if I can rack my memory and do it off the top of my head.
I know how the deadline stuff works. But.
Yeah. I call it a number of things. There are a few ways to do it, but I kind of call it my premise line machine. And so it's four questions. It is, who is your protagonist? What do they want? Or what do they have to achieve to solve the overarching story goal? What's at stake? And who or what will oppose them? And then you put all of those elements into a very concise sentence or two. And if you can't do that, then you really haven't got all those elements nailed down. And it sounds very simple. But it turns out to be very hard, even for me now, yes. But that's what I call the premise line machine.
Hmm. Yeah, that really boils the story down to its very core, doesn't it? Because there's a lot of other things going to be going on other beyond just the heart of that. But that really would help to direct the whole arc of the tale from start to finish.
Yeah, and once you've got your premise line, then you kind of know whether the plot points and things that you're assembling under it support that premise line. Does it move the story in that direction or not? And then you can start making choices that way.
There's a book called The Moral Premise that I read, I don't know, maybe a year ago, and I was just glancing over here to see if I could locate it, but I don't see it. But his kind of view is that in every kind of book, you have, I guess you'd say the stakes, like maybe this book, the theme is friendship or something, and that it would be like you would state both the vice and the virtue of that. So you'd be like, with a friend, you can accomplish more than alone, but without a friend, you're on your own. I don't know, I'm just making this up, you know, but in his case, he would say every scene has to almost mirror or be encapsulating this moral premise, or it shouldn't be in the book. And I don't really agree with that.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Or actually, his was written more for screenwriters, you know, for movies, and that in every scene you should have kind of this, you know, almost. But I'm kind of thinking, well, what if I'm watching your film or something and I kind of get it? I'm like, okay, I get it. Friendship's important. Then the next scene, oh, friendship. I'm like, okay, I'm bored. Just tell me a story, you know, so.
That sounds more like something that from an intellectual perspective would be very satisfying. Like you could present this piece of literature as a model of how, you know, a perfect work. But I'm not sure that, as you say, in real life, if you were reading it or watching it, if that would really be so desirable to restrict yourself in that way.
So good. So okay, so you talk us through premise. What's another thing that you've seen that you're like, these people really kind of need to get a better beat on this?
Well, I always tell students, and again, this is something that wasn't necessarily true for me for many years, but I tell them that successful writers make conscious decisions about what goes in the book. Everything that is in there serves a purpose. And, you know, I kind of have three or four bullet points that I nail down. I say, if you're willing to, you can go through every sentence of your book and ask if this line or this paragraph serves one or more of these, you know, these musts that I give them. And I think that's another light bulb moment, because they've realized that I've just been putting stuff in because it seemed to work, but they haven't thought about it. And it can be a little scary thinking I need to analyze everything I put in the book, but it gets to be second nature over time. So that's another one.
Yeah, I think you mentioned this too earlier, Grant, was, you know, all of the choices that, you know, writers need to make when they look at it, there's so many factors that we need to keep in mind. And recently someone sent me something to look at, and I normally don't, but I was like, okay, well, I'll look at your work or something. And after about 15 pages, I was just like, I wrote some notes down, comments and stuff, and sent it back. But he wrote, and he's like, well, I have reasons for all of these things that you noted, but obviously they weren't right or something. And my point is, it's not right or wrong necessarily. It's not a mistake or an error.
No.
But it's maybe that you didn't take all of these factors into consideration. Like, and, you know, quite frankly, I think this is why some writers' groups aren't that helpful, because you go to the writers' group and then someone, you know, gives you suggestion, and they might have learned about desire, like, you know, the importance of desire at a conference or writing a book. But they don't also understand, you know, the importance of context and movement, believability, you know, escalation, and all of these other forces that really press in. And so they're actually critiquing it from a limited perspective, where they only have in their toolbox a few tools. And the more that you write, the more of these tools you get. And you're like, wait, because that's that kind of screw, that one's not going to work. And so I've almost found that the more I learn about writing, the more I read about it or talk to successful authors and screenplay writers and so on, the more I'm like, okay, now I've got to keep this in mind when I write. It almost gets harder, because I now have so many more, you know, facets to look through when I'm looking at the story.
It's both exciting and mind-numbing to think that, oh, yeah, this is something else I need to start thinking about. But, you know, it's the business we love, and so we put up with it.
Grant, what do you think about the role of rewrites and, you know, going back and editing in terms of this? Because there's so much to juggle in a long piece of work. What do you teach your students about, you know, processes of coming back and looking for these things?
Well, I'm a big fan, I'm sure you guys are too, of the phrase that writing is rewriting. There are very few authors who do a perfect first draft. Maybe Stephen King, I don't know. But it also, knowing that you're going to do rewrites, it really takes the pressure off first draft. You realize that nothing is set in stone until it is. But some of the things I tell them to do is go back through and ask for everything in there about the conscious decisions I talked about. Does it advance plot? Does it build or enhance characterization? Does it immerse the reader in the world? And if you can go through and look at each of those pages, and more often than not, there's a reason for being there, you're in good shape. The other thing I tell them, I encourage everybody to do is, and this is where Stephen and I have had many discussions, you can make your job down the line a lot easier if you outline the book first. But that, I think that helps rewrites, but it's you know, kind of laying out the book first solves a lot of problems you don't even know exist at that point.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting because, you know, there are different approaches as far as outline or don't outline. I know I write organically, but I've had people on our show here who write 200-page single-space outlines of their books.
Wow.
Oh, my.
And, you know, so to me, that approach isn't helpful, you know. But I think that, you know, Grant, what was the thing we spoke about last year, I think, was acts, three acts or four or something like that. Now, do you set down the number of acts that you think you're going to have, three or four or whatever, or do you sort of let the act structure emerge from your outline?
The latter. I think when I started, one, I was such a newbie at this, I wasn't even sure what they were talking about when they talked about three-act structure. And so it was something that, one, I couldn't do well, and so I didn't concentrate on it. But I think a lot of books end up falling into that act structure. Why they do, I don't know. But I think planning a book by act structure, it can really kind of tie your hands.
Yeah.
But it can also be a really good thing. There are people in Hollywood who don't believe in the three-act structure anymore. They think it's just it went out with the mammoths. So there's a lot of differences of opinion about it.
Now, tell us a little bit about your connection with Tom Clancy. Now, I can't remember how many books you have done with him or in connection with his characters, but I know a lot of our listeners are interested in Tom Clancy. Many are fans, and many are fans of the books that you've written, you know, with Jack Ryan Jr. But how did that maybe kind of get started, or, you know, I just think it's fascinating.
Back about 10 years ago or so, I did, as a kind of a ghostwriter, I did some books that were in the Clancy universe, but not, you know, part of his main universe.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up working with some of his people, his agents, and we got along well, and the books did well, and so I kind of got on their radar. And when Dead or Alive came up, I think it was 2009, and they were looking for somebody to kind of hop in and do a little bit of the work, I was thankfully at the top of their list, and they asked.
Excellent.
And how am I going to say no to an offer like that? So that's how it started. And that was, you know, Dead or Alive came out in 2011, and I took a break, and then Under Fire this last year. And in between that, Mark Greene has been doing, well, he does one of the two Clancy books that comes out every year.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah, I know Mark. We met up at a conference too. He's a quiet guy, but there's a lot going on. Like,
yeah.
You know, in his mind, you can tell he's always sorting through lots of information.
Yeah, I think the gears are always turning.
Yeah, the gears are turning.
In a good way, yeah.
Yeah. I think I'd been in touch with him once. He said, yeah, I'm going to China to write my next book because it happens there. I'm doing research or something for the next month or whatever. And I was like, that is great, you know, because he takes it seriously. And that research angle is something that I wanted to ask you a little bit about. And especially with techno thrillers, you've got to get the facts right. If someone does something wrong with a gun or with any piece of technology, your readers are going to be like, that would never happen. He would never do that. And
right.
How do you do that detailed research, but also balance it off with, you know, an exciting story?
You know, I get things wrong all the time, and I do hear about it. But one of the things I try to keep in mind is that there's fact, and then there's authenticity. And I think if you have a choice between a fact that feels authentic, make that choice. But if a fact is really going to take you far outside the goal of the story, you really should be looking for something that's authentic feeling to the reader, because what they want to do is they want to be immersed in that world. I think there are more people like that than people that feel disappointed if you get the, you know, the ammunition count of a Glock 19 wrong.
Right.
You do need to be careful. I don't get it right all the time, and they tell me, but and I think it makes it easier. Having done this for so long, I kind of can sense early on the things I know I'm going to need to know. Whereas when I started out, I thought I needed to know everything under the sun, and I researched accordingly. So somewhere I've gotten a little smarter.
You've had a lot of life experience, you know, prior to your writing career that should give you good material for this, right? When Steve introduced you, he said you were a pilot rescue swimmer and a variety of things. I was kind of wondering what a pilot rescue swimmer is. Somebody who rescues pilots, or it's a pilot who swims?
All pilots can swim. That's a prerequisite, thankfully. I served aboard a guided missile frigate. And pilots rescue swimmers on board ship, they really do one thing usually, and that is we set up behind a carrier when the carrier is doing flight ops, and you are there in case a pilot goes in the water, there's an accident or they hit the ramp or whatever, then you might go in and help them. That never happened, thankfully. The rescue swimmers that you see in the Coast Guard and things like that, those are helicopter-borne rescue swimmers. Those are the people that really go into those dicey sinking ship situations. So there are all kinds of varieties. I just happen to be the shipborne variety.
But Steve, was your chance to tell us that you really were the helicopter getting into the sinking ship guy. Everyone would have said, man, wow.
I'm saying,
well,
man,
here's the
wow
thing.
Anyway.
Here's the thing is I do so much lying for a living. Happily, and my readers like when I tell big, long, 100,000-word lies. I try to be as truthful about everything else in my life. So, no, I wasn't really the fancy kind of swimmer, but I was there. So
nice.
Well, it's still pretty cool, and I'm wondering, how does this all play into your writing? You know, you've got these tremendous, or at least interesting experiences that most people do not have.
Well, for sure, you know, being in the Navy, I grew up a lot, and so I don't think it was a coincidence that I started chasing this dream of being a fiction writer within months of getting out of the Navy. So I think for sure that kind of discipline and refocus helped me start on the path. But also I think in action books, being in the military, you get this kind of feel, this fuzzy feel for how things work and look in that world and how people think about different situations. It's hard to explain, but I think all people in the military kind of come out with that mindset in a way, and I've just been able to kind of funnel it into fiction.
I think I noticed that. I read one of your Tucker Wayne novels that you co-wrote with James Rollins, and I definitely got the feeling that the person who wrote this book understood the military. And I couldn't name any specific detail necessarily that pointed that out, but you could definitely tell that the main character, who is ex-military, had that world view and that it was authentic from words that he used, some of the way that he perceived certain situations was in a way that I you know, perceived to be different from someone who has not had those experiences.
No, I appreciate that. In fact, that's, you know, I like to think I've gotten it right, mostly right all these years, but actually that's the first time someone has mentioned that ephemeral feeling of authenticity about a character's mindset that I've written. So I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that fits in with the old sort of thing, you know, that saying, write what you know, and some people say, don't write what you know because it's boring. Write what you know because you're an expert on it, and how can you not write what you know because it's the only thing you know? I'm like, always. But,
yeah,
how does that fit in with that aspect, you know?
I think it's certainly for nonfiction, you need to be writing what you know. That's just a given. But we're in the business of telling stories. And I think there are certain genres where, yeah, an authentic approach, having been there and done that, is really important. But I think we're all in the business of telling stories that are not true but feel true and feel exciting.
Right.
And so rarely is a person going to come to one of our kind of books having done all that. And so you have to muddle through. You have to try to get it right and give the reader the experience they're looking for.
I think if I could chime in on that, I think part of it depends on what readers you're trying to reach and how comfortable you are about having some readers who are disappointed, so to speak, by your inaccuracies. I see this
mm-hmm.
a lot with medical thrillers, that to write a medical thriller, you just need a good story, and you don't have to be a doctor or to know a lot about hospitals, and most people will read it, and as a story, if it seems authentic to them, it's, you know, they're happy and they'll love it. But if somebody who does have that experience reads it, they will know in an instant that the person writing it does not have firsthand experience in a hospital,
yes.
for example.
Yeah,
and
it will be glaringly obvious.
It
yeah,
will
absolutely.
Be. And,
yeah.
and so in that sense, you know, if you choose to write something that you don't know, so to speak, something that you don't have that global sense of how it works, this particular place, a particular type of career setting, you can certainly tell a fantastic story, but you will have people who with expertise in that area who will notice. And that may be perfectly fine.
It's, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. One of the most frequent compliments I get came from End of Enemies, which is my first novel ever back in 2001. I've been asked a surprising number of times how much time I spent in Beirut researching the book.
Oh, nice.
And the truth is, if I really count up all the hours I spent researching Beirut by going to the library, it's probably hundreds of hours. So I'm always thankful for that compliment. But, you know, and that's what we strive for as fiction writers, is people coming away feeling like they've been there and they've done that.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you were talking, I was trying to think back to things I've heard from readers, and I think the biggest compliment I've ever gotten about my Patrick Bauer's novels is this guy said, "I've been a detective for 17 years, and when I read your books, I feel like I'm at a crime scene again."
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, for me, I mean, I've never worked law enforcement. I've never
right.
been in the military or any of that. But I really do try to take care to be authentic, like what you were saying, Grant. It's like there's facts and authenticity, and I really want it to feel, you know, authentic. And like you were saying, Amy, people can tell, like, if you've put in the time and if you've really gotten to understand and come from that perspective, whether it's a medical thriller or crime drama or whatever it might be. But, and I think it's a matter of respecting your readers.
Mm-hmm. Readers are smart.
Yeah.
You need to remember that when you're writing. They're smart and they have great imaginations, and never take that for granted.
Absolutely.
Now, when you're working on a big project, I mean, some of your books are even, you know, you said 100,000. I'm guessing probably even more than that, some of your novels, and there's all these moving parts. How do you kind of keep those track of everybody and on all of the different pieces of the puzzle as you're developing it? And, you know, I notice a lot of times if I read a book that has a lot of working parts or characters and so on, that some tend to get lost for some maybe 100 pages or something, or the pace gets off because the author ends up spending too much time developing this one storyline, and it ends up dragging down the other ones. How do you approach that, or what's your secret to making the book one cohesive, you know, fast-paced, moving story?
You know, all the really big books I've done. So Dead or Alive was, Dead or Alive was 220,000 words. So that was, you know, a typical Tom Clancy book, which is to be expected because it was his book. He put it together, and I just helped a little bit. But big books like that, one, I do an outline, which helps a lot. So I've kind of smoothed out wrinkles and solved problems beforehand. But I think another thing is just repetition. Living in that world for so long and thinking it, breathing it, I think you just kind of keep track of details kind of in your head without realizing. But the other thing is I do keep a lot of notes.
Yeah.
I keep detailed notes about who said what when, and I have timelines, and I do mind maps. And because, like you said, Stephen, you can, if you get off a little bit on a tangent in a big book, that domino effect can be pretty devastating down the line if you're not careful.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of do the same stuff. So we actually might accept outlining.
we actually
might be closer than you expect. But
I have been amazed at the number of things that we writers do that other writers do. They just call it something else.
Yeah.
And when you talk about it, you say, well, yeah, that's exactly what I do. I just happen to call it this.
Yeah, keeping track, keeping the notes, timelines, and all of that stuff is vital, you know.
Right, yep.
Yeah. In my last book, there were 56 named characters. And trying to keep, and people are like, how do you keep them straight? But I think it was the same thing you just said, that when you live in that world for months on end, you just remember them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the landscape of your work and your life.
So when you're doing that with a co-author, is that even more complicated to try to keep track of all that stuff?
It is. It's easier, though, when, you know, you and your co-author ahead of time know what kind of book you're writing. You know what the purpose of the book is. And if you're kind of like mind when it comes to how those books should play out and how they look, it makes it a lot easier because you started on the same, if you will, page. There's a lot of back and forth that goes on to make sure that, you know, a choice I've made here doesn't screw up, you know, the author or other author's thought down the line.
Right.
So it does take a lot of coordination.
But your newest book, Warhawk, right? That one, that's a solo book.
That's with Jim Rollins.
Oh, that one is with Jim Rollins. Okay, nice,
right.
Yeah. And that one comes out this spring, I think.
April 19th, I believe, yes.
Excellent. Well, do you want to give us a little teaser without giving too much away? Because I want my listeners, I want all of our listeners to go check out your books. I mean, I've got them on my shelf. I don't have the newest one, obviously, but Amy somehow was able to read one copy that I haven't even been able to look at.
Great. Especially if you love dogs.
Especially if
right.
you love dogs. Okay, well, give us a teaser here.
Well, Warhawk, of course, starts shortly after the end of the first Tucker Wayne book, which is The Kill Switch. Tucker is approached by an old friend, and it turns out that she and her son are in trouble. They're being hunted, and they have a mutual friend that has also disappeared, and she asks Tucker to get involved. And really quickly, he realizes that, as with all books like this, there's a lot more going on. It involves artificial intelligence. It involves an incident in World War II with a decoding center in England, and some technology that is beyond cutting edge, and it belongs to a person who has very, very bad things planned. So Tucker has to derail all of that while also keeping his dog fed along the way.
Well, tell them about Kane. Tell them about Kane. They don't know about Kane.
Okay. Well, for those who don't know, Tucker Wayne and his dog Kane, they were a team in the military. He was an Army Ranger, and Kane is a Belgian Malinois, which is kind of the standard war dog in the military right now. A Malinois, also known as a Belgian Shepherd, is about 70 pounds. It can have vocabulary up to 1,000 words. And they are just amazing dogs, the things they can do, not just physically but mentally. And so Tucker and Kane left the Army together, and now they travel about, and they're kind of almost vagabonds in a way. And occasionally they find themselves in trouble and solving problems.
When you said that about the Belgian, I don't even know how to say it, Malinois. I was
Malinois,
talking with this guy who does, who was training one day out at, he was from the Sheriff's Department. And he mentioned that they're also, they can smell like amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that they would put a drop of blood in a car and then clean it off and then have the dog go in to try and see where the blood was. So that they would use these dogs to try and investigate cars where they thought murders had occurred or where there might be blood that people wiped off. Isn't that astonishing?
It is astonishing. And I, you know, the Malinois are especially good at that. But, you know, just this afternoon I snacked my dogs. And I dropped a biscuit under the fridge. And one of my dogs, he pawed at it until I finally moved the fridge out. So not only do they have good smell, but they're persistent that way. So
and
they're
like
able to
biscuits.
Use tools like humans.
That's right.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, excellent. So, Warhawk, that sounds great. So, tell us, where is the best place online where readers can find out about your books or maybe book signings, appearances that you might be making?
Just go to grantblackwood.com, and then I'll have details up. We haven't got information on Warhawk quite yet, but we're going to. And then Duty and Honor, which is the next Clancy, will come out in June, and I'll soon have information up on my website, grantblackwood.com.
Excellent. And Amy, what about you? Your newest book is out and available, and tell us the name of that and where we can find it.
You can find Reversion anywhere books are sold on the internet. The best place to find out about me and my science-themed thrillers, which usually have microbiology in them, is at amyrogers.com. No D in Rogers. And if you've already read my books and you're looking for more science-themed fiction, go to sciencethrillers.com, where you'll find over 100 book reviews that I've written about books in that genre.
Excellent. And for info about the novel writing intensive retreats that I teach around the country, click to novelwritingintensive.com. We're starting to take registrations for the next one coming up in the fall. And, of course, for info about our guests and other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.